All right, well, let's move on to the cosmological argument, or the family of arguments. And let me distinguish the cosmological argument from other types of arguments. We've talked about the ontological argument, the argument from the very concept of God as a maximal and perfect being, greatest conceivable being who cannot not exist. That's a priori reasoning. There's a design argument that we'll come to next week, several design arguments, that argues a posteriori, that is empirically, that given the shape of things, the macro and the micro, there's evidence of a mind at work. That time and space and chance and matter cannot account for the universe as a whole, given its fine-tunedness, or for maybe individual structures, like the bacterial flagellum or the blood clotting cascade in organisms and so on. There's the moral argument, which deals with moral experience and moral sense, which is a kind of empirical argument, but it emphasizes inner sense or inner understanding. Claims that if we have an awareness of a moral order that transcends ourselves, the best way to explain this is not according to matter or energy or cultural conditioning, but according to something that is transcendent, a personal moral source of the moral law. And we also have religious experience arguments, which we'll come back to, that look at various experiences people have and claim that the best explanation for these types of experience are not that they are deluded or that they are projecting something they wish to be true or that they've been drugged or something, but they are having an experience of an object outside of themselves. So these are different forms of argument, different types of natural theology. Now, there are various forms of cosmological arguments. Let me briefly talk about the principle of sufficient reason version and then talk a little bit about Cordovan's version and then get into the Kalam version, which you may have noticed is fairly complex. But if you get down some basic ideas about the potential infinite, the actual infinite, and if you can invoke some empirical factors from Big Bang cosmology, I think it starts to make sense. Now, the Leibnizian version, recently given by Richard Taylor, recently, 30 years ago, as given by other philosophers, appeals to something called the principle of sufficient reason or sufficient explanation, which says something like, for any positive state of affairs, there is a reason for its existence either in itself or in another. So it's claiming that everything that exists is explicable, is intelligible, and is explicable. So the notion is that the universe does not explain itself. It's contingent. It could have not existed at all. If it does exist, there needs to be a sufficient reason for why it exists. Because otherwise, it would exist literally without reason. And things do not exist without reason. That for any positive state of affairs, there is some sufficient explanation for why it exists. Whether it's an individual thing, like a pebble on the beach, or whether it's the whole universe, that there is a sufficient explanation. Now, I think this can be used as a very powerful argument, but the debate comes over the logical status of the principle of sufficient reason. What kind of a principle is it? Is it a preference? Some people like to believe it and others don't. Is it a principle of logic, a necessary truth like the law of non-contradiction? If so, it has to be the case. Is it maybe slightly weaker, like a synthetic a priori proposition? Is it more likely true than false, so it's probabilistically true? We could spend a lot of time on the principle of sufficient reason. I think it's a basic, I agree with Taylor here, it's a basic intuition of rational thought. But people can deny it. I mean, what if all of a sudden something very bizarre happens that you don't expect at all? Do you ever think to yourself, well, it just happened without a cause and without a reason? It just occurred without any sufficient explanation or reason for its occurrence. I don't think you do. When things puzzle us, we try to find explanations for them. And the principle of sufficient reason, using a cosmological argument, applies it to the entire universe, the entire cosmos. Why does it exist, as opposed to not existing? There must be a reason outside of itself. And the argument claims that the reason is in a necessary being, a being who must exist, and a being whose existence explains everything else. So you might say that God is self-explicable, because God is a necessary being. God cannot fail to exist. God has always existed. But the universe is different. The universe is contingent. It might not have existed. Or it might have existed in a very different form. So why does it take the form it now has? Let me give you an example of how you can resist this. It's a very classic case of a debate between Bertrand Russell and Frederick Copleston, 1948, I believe it was. We have it on tape in the library. I have no idea how we got it. But we have part of this debate, the cosmological part of it. And Father Copleston is attempting to give a kind of cosmological argument for God as the best explanation for the universe. And Russell says, well, for anything in the universe, you can try to ascertain why it exists, explain the necessary and sufficient conditions for why it's there and what it is. But for the universe as a whole, the universe is just there. Just there. So there's no explanation for it. So what he's doing is making the entire universe what philosophers call a brute fact. A brute fact means there's no explanation for it. It happens to be there. But there's no explanation. Now, we'll come back to this when we look at Big Bang cosmology and the Kalam argument, when people claim that the universe came into existence out of nothing, without a cause and without a reason. Now, in 1948, Big Bang cosmology was only in its very infancy. It was not well established. And Russell and most atheists would claim that the universe has always existed. Today, the atheists, like Quentin Smith and others, if they admit the universe came into existence out of nothing, have to say it came out of nothing for no reason and without a cause. So in another sense, the universe is merely a brute fact. There is no explanation for it. It's just here. All right. Now, one of the implications of denying the principle of sufficient reason is a moral and spiritual implication, is that there is no undergirding or overarching meaning to the universe, because it's just there. Whatever meaning you have in the universe is imposed by finite entities and agents. And they may oppose each other. They're in conflict quite often. So I think it really ends up reducing to nihilism if you deny the principle of sufficient reason as applicable to the universe as a whole, which is an interesting result. Some people can live with nihilistic implications and conclusions, and others cannot. But let's come to a more Thomistic or neo-Thomistic argument that Cordouin gives. And this trades really on the ideas of causal contingency and necessity. Now, I have to make a few more distinctions, because there's so many families of arguments, and they each argue a little differently. Some cosmological arguments argue that if the universe exists, God must exist as its cause. But they do not claim that the universe came into existence a finite time ago out of nothing. They say all we can claim through this argument that is, if the universe exists, God exists. And that may have been the way it was forever. That is, God has always existed, and the universe has always existed. These versions are called concurrent cosmological arguments. They deal with concurrent causation. So they'd say, given the vast panoply of causes and effects in the universe cannot support itself. It cannot keep itself in existence. So right now, there has to be a cause of the universe outside of the universe itself. And we'll get to that. But it may have been that God has existed for as long as the universe. Now, of course, that would give you the existence of a first cause, but not a chronologically first cause. You'd only have a metaphysically first cause. The most significant or the most powerful cause would be God. But God would not precede the existence of the universe because they have both always existed. Now, the argument that the Kalam gives and that the Big Bang cosmology gives is better. That's that the universe came into being a finite time ago. That's much more compatible. That is compatible with Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, creation ex nihilo. Now, Aquinas argued that the cosmological argument can give you the existence of God given the universe, but you have to learn creation ex nihilo from the Bible. That is, the Bible, as special revelation, tells us many things that philosophy itself cannot tell us. I, in fact, think that from natural theology you can develop a good argument for creation ex nihilo. Okay. Now, Corduan gives us an argument of various stages, and he doesn't really, well, he does identify it. He says it's a Thomistic or a Neo-Thomistic argument. And I want to work my way through that fairly quickly, but I want to spend more time on the Kalam argument because I think it's, in some ways, a more powerful argument. Now, Corduan doesn't really tell us which argument he's going for. Is he going for an absolute origination argument? Or is he giving an eternal universe argument? I'm just not sure which one he's attempting to give us. I know that as an evangelical, he believes in the absolute origination of the universe out of nothing, caused by God. But the Thomistic arguments typically tend to be the eternal universe arguments. Now, let me give you an example if you're not following what I'm saying, in terms of the God always existed and the universe always existed. It would be this kind of a causation. Okay, my hand is supporting the book. Now, just imagine that having existed forever. My hand would always be the support for the book. But it would not be as if I created the book. But it has always supported the book. That's a type of causation, or dependency, you might say. Now, other types of cosmological arguments try to give us a first temporal event caused by the first cause, that is God. Those arguments are more powerful. I think we can use Corduan's basic Thomistic argument, though, and intimate a first temporal, or you might say chronological, cause. All right? The first premise is not too controversial. Something exists. Something. Whatever it is, you don't have to really specify. You do have to specify if you start using empirical evidence for, let's say, the Big Bang, because that assumes there is an external material world. Now, some worldviews deny that. Some worldviews say that what appears to be a material world of various shaped and sized objects is really an illusion of the mind. They have to deal with those kind of arguments, those kinds of perspectives in a different way. But I think most people in the Western world would grant that something exists and something material exists. So for anything that exists, there are basically two categories ontologically. Something is contingent or necessary. If something is contingent, it means that it's caused, dependent, and determined. So think of a book. A book has not always existed. Books have not always existed. They're caused by other things. People coming up with the idea for the books, the physical determination of the book, the continuation of the book, and if conditions change, the book could not exist. It could be destroyed in a fire. It could be pulverized or ground up or something like that. So it's contingent, and it's determined by factors outside of itself. Now think of that as one basic category of being, the contingent. Think of yourself as contingent. What are you contingent upon? Air? Proper environment? Gravity? That's part of the environment. Yeah, just the constants of the universe and so on. Your parents? You're dependent on a lot of different things. So you're a contingent being. Now, first of all, we just want to talk about the concept of a necessary being, whether or not there is one. The concept of a necessary being would be a being that does not depend on anything outside of itself, a being that is self-existent. You probably shouldn't say self-caused, because if you're thinking of causation in a linear sense, one thing after another, something cannot cause itself to come into existence in a causal series. That makes no sense. If by self-caused you mean the principle for its existence is in itself and not in anything else, it is self-determining, self-existent, non-contingent, then you have the concept. And all you need right now is the concept. Now, we need to consider whether the universe fits into the category of a collection of contingent beings, or a necessary being. What do you think? When you consider the universe, you can consider that it might have been very different. It could have been without life entirely. Just given a few changes in the fine-tuning of the universe, there could be no life whatsoever. There could be nothing at all. Some have said that the first philosophical question, the deepest philosophical question, is why is there something rather than nothing? So the universe is made up of contingent things, and there seems to be good reason that the universe as a whole is contingent. Now, it could be it's made up of contingent things, but somehow, as a whole, it's necessary. But the burden of proof would be on the person that says, as a whole, it's necessary, because things like the second law of thermodynamics, things running down, constant change in the universe, flux, and so on, anything you look at in the universe is conditioned by other things. So it seems to be a comprehensive situation of conditioned states of affairs. So if it applies to each part of the universe, and we don't seem to find anything that exists in and of itself, a se, you know, in and of itself, has aseity, self-existence, we don't see anything like that, we don't observe anything like that. Aseity means self-existence. It seems to make sense to say that the universe itself is contingent. All right, you with me so far? Now, can you have an infinite series of contingent states? Now, you can think of this either in terms of concurrent contingency or linear contingency. Linear contingency has to do with whether or not there's a first temporal cause of the universe. Concurrent contingency has to do with whether or not the universe had a beginning. Could it exist self-enclosed? Is there what naturalists call causal closure in the universe? There's nothing supernatural supporting the universe. It's all natural. It's physical, natural, material, contingent properties all the way down. Could it be like that? Now, Corduan claims that an infinitely long series of contingent states is impossible. Or, unless there is a necessary being, there can be no contingent beings. Now, what are some of the examples he gives there? Yeah, can you have a train that has locomotion without a locomotive? You need a source of motion, a source of power to actualize the potential. It's another way of looking at it. So that's one. What's another example? Yeah, the chandelier. Can you imagine a chandelier hanging by an infinite chain that is not attached to anything? That's another example, another analogy. Anything else? There's one other one. Yeah, coffee cup. Can a coffee cup fill itself? No, the potential has to be actualized by something outside of itself. So the question is whether or not you can have endless contingency. And the argument is that positing a necessary being, a first metaphysical being, explains the vast panoply of contingent states. Another way of putting it is that you can't jump out of a bottomless pit. There has to be a basis. There has to be a foundation. Otherwise, it would not exist the universe would not exist at all. Now, let me give you some analogies that Cordouin does not give. This is something that I wrote. Consider a linear series of causally related events, and I'm talking about linear now, not concurrent. Consider a linear series of causally related events where each event depends on a previous event, such that event B depends on event C and C depends on D, etc. Suppose I desire to borrow $100 from B, but B must first borrow the money from C, who must first borrow the money from D, etc. Ad infinitum. All right, ad infinitum. Some of you are thinking, sounds like my student loan situation. It is claimed that I will never receive the $100 if no one in the linear dependent causal series ever originally possesses the money required for there to be any borrowing. And although the borrowing example draws on a finite situation, the further claim is made that even an infinite number of borrowers will never generate a receiving of the money if there is no original, unborrowing possessor and giver of the needed funds that makes the ensuing borrowing possible. Or think of permissions. Let's say you need permission to build an extension to your home, and then you go to the state and they have to ask someone else, and they have to ask someone else, and they have to ask someone else, ad infinitum. Would you ever receive the permission to build the extension? I don't think so. You can use these kind of examples to get the intuition churning, chugging a little bit. Because people who say, well, the universe is just there and there's nothing but the universe, you have to kind of work their common sense a little bit and talk about this notion of contingency and ask whether or not it makes sense to have endless contingency all the way down without a non-contingent originating cause or support for the rest of it. So Cordouin argues that you need a first cause to begin the series. And that first cause would be a necessary and non-contingent being. Otherwise, you'd have the whole causal regress problem again. Now, remember, you are not saying for any state of affairs, that state of affairs requires a cause. Then you'd have to say, who created God? Who caused God? The claim for this kind of an argument is that for any contingent state of affairs, you cannot have an infinite regress of contingent states as the explanation. God is by definition not a contingent being. So the buck stops here metaphysically. So people who say, well, who caused God? You say you don't understand the concept of God and you don't understand where the argument leads. If you can't have endless contingency, you have a non-contingent being. Now, if you can give a good argument for endless contingency, that's something else. Yes?
Can you go back to number three then? Because I mean, this is where Bertrand Russell argues, right? And I guess the why the universe can't be that contingent. That not contingent entity, or not that necessary. So that's what he tries to argue.
Right. Well, I'm saying that if everything in the universe seems contingent, it's not a stretch to say the entire universe is contingent, unless you can say that there's some reason to assume that necessity is an emergent property, that it comes out of all this endless contingency. That just doesn't make sense. That's like water rising above its own source. Okay? Now, you can supplement this tremendously from the Kalam argument and from Big Bang cosmology. The Kalam argument was not really off the ground in 1948. I mean, it had been off the ground centuries previously, mostly with Islamic philosophers, but it was really Bill Craig in the late 70s that revived the argument, and now it's a very powerful, very attractive argument, and we have the whole Big Bang cosmology to support creation ex nihilo as well. So the atheists today are typically not saying there's an eternal universe. Some of them still try to posit something before the Big Bang that was there that explains it. But some of them, like Quentin Smith and others, are really, really biting the bullet and saying everything came out of nothing without a cause. So the whole causal matrix from the beginning of the universe, this is the beginning of the universe, all of this just pops into existence. So before this, there was literally nothing. And then everything. And everything came from nothing without a cause and without a purpose. That's what many of the modern atheists are saying. So contingency funnels back to that original singularity of the Big Bang. They can't even deny that. But then the question is explaining that without an intelligent cause. We'll come back to that in a moment. Yes?
Is there another Mm-hmm. Then the person you're arguing with might say, well, so then this rule applies to everything except for God.
Yeah, but it's not arbitrary, because when you consider the nature of the universe, you consider the objects in the universe, it shows signs of contingency. So to say that that's necessary is basically to make the universe divine, to make it self-existent, to make it indestructible and so on. And that just doesn't fit the universe. I mean, we know it came into existence. Something that came into existence can't be necessary. It's intrinsically contingent. So the question is, why did it come into existence? And the atheists say, for no reason whatsoever. There is no necessary being. They might claim that there are necessary truths, things that must exist, but in terms of a being, a personal being, they say there is no such being. Now, there are other things that are necessarily true, like propositions are necessarily true. But necessary being is a different category. You're talking about an agent with mind and will and the ability to act. That's a being. All right? Now, Cordon goes on to say there is one necessary being. You might say, well, why not many? He's got an argument there in terms of a necessary being not being limited by anything outside of itself. So you can't really have more than one. Another way of dealing with it is that there's no reason to posit more than one because of explanatory simplicity and metaphysical coherence. Why posit more than one if one does all the explaining? It's just gratuitous. Moreover, the necessary being cannot cease to exist. Some people have worried, well, there might have been a being that started everything, but that being then ceased to exist. Look, if a being has the power of existence in itself and is not contingent, dependent on anything else, it cannot cease to exist. It possesses self-existence. So there's no threat, either internally or externally. Now, I think we can reasonably say that this being is God. That is, this being possesses attributes necessary for deity and unique to deity. Whatever other attributes it may possess. Now, I think we need to work the Kalam argument to fill out our picture of God. Because what flows from the concept of a necessary being? Well, a limitless being, an extremely powerful being, and in fact, if you argue for creation ex nihilo, I think we're warranted in saying an all-powerful being. Now, does that being have personality or not? Or is it some impersonal principle? Well, the Kalam gives a pretty good argument that it has to be a personal being, which I'll get to in a moment. And we can also argue for the personality of God through the moral argument and through religious experience arguments, let alone the ways we can argue it from Scripture. So Cordowin may try to push it a little too far with all those attributes that he lists that flow out of the idea of a necessary being. But you do have very significant omni-attributes, being unlimited, being self-existent. Any attribute that this being would possess, it would be unlimited in the extent of the attribute, because there's nothing outside of this being that makes it contingent, that makes it dependent, that makes it ontologically unstable or queasy or something to that effect. Now, I think the argument needs to be supplemented by empirical factors from the Big Bang cosmology. And I really like the kind of argument that works back to a first cause philosophically, based on the impossibility of instantiating an actual infinite. But there are different ways of arguing the cosmological case. Questions or comments so far about Cordowin's version? Yes?
Does Cordowin's version necessarily argue for a single God theism? I didn't find his idea of not having more than one first being,
for example, first cause.
A yin yang type of thing where you have one God who is infinitely good and one God who is infinitely evil. That would still may, therefore make them twins, and I don't think that necessitates violating any other of the supernatural or the infinite characteristics.
Well, if one is good and one is evil, they wouldn't be twins. They'd be quite different. That doesn't work for a variety of reasons. First of all, he gives the argument that if you possess these qualities of necessity, then nothing else could limit you, so there couldn't be more than one of these types of beings. Moreover, it's just more simple to explain things according to the minimal number of entities, all things considered. Okay? Now, another problem is, that's Occam's razor, another problem is the nature of evil. Evil is parasitic on the good and is derivative of the good. We'll come back to this later, but evil is not co-equal with the good. Evil is good gone wrong. C.S. Lewis does a very good job on this in Mere Christianity. It's essentially an Augustinian insight, reflecting on the Bible and on Neoplatonism. But evil always presupposes a good that's been corrupted. So to talk about an original, metaphysically unique, absolute evil is incoherent. We'll come back to that when we talk about the moral argument and we talk about the problem of evil. Okay. Anything else on Corduan? Yes. Yeah, that's roughly more like deism, that God created the universe to be self-existent. Now, Christian theism claims that God created the universe ex nihilo, but God continues to conserve the existence of the universe. So, if at this moment God, per impossible, turned himself off, there would be no universe. I mean, look at Hebrews 1. Christ upholds the world by the word of his power. He upholds it, created it, John 1:1, but he also conserves it or keeps it in existence. Now, the keeping it in existence element is the concurrent cosmological argument. It says, given the vast assemblage of present events, can the universe explain itself, let alone whether or not it had a beginning? But just given right now, can it explain itself in a closed sense? And the eternal universe versions of the argument say no. Even if the universe is eternal, it can't exist by itself. It needs the eternal support of God. That's the concurrent version. Or it's sometimes called the vertical version. The horizontal version goes back to a first temporal cause. And that's the bang-up argument. I mean, that's the meaty argument. That's frankly the one that I want, because it fits right in with Genesis 1:1 and John 1:1. Does that help? Okay. Anything other things? Yes. Good sense of fairness there. Yeah. Who is it going? Ralph, yes.
When I read your book on Pascal and I saw a discussion about vacuum, it raised the question about whether or not vacuum could be a necessary self-existent condition. Can
Yeah, well, Pascal was arguing that nature does have vacuums. And people argued metaphysically, not empirically, that nature could not contain a vacuum. But a vacuum is simply an absence of substance. It's not anything like a necessary being. Now, people want to get really fancy and talk about quantum vacuums being the source. It's not a brand of vacuum cleaner, but the quantum vacuum being the source of everything. Because basically what's happening is that the standard model or Big Bang model implies a creation of everything out of nothing, an absolute origination of the universe. And a lot of people are metaphysically ill at ease with that concept because it's so close to biblical theism. And they are attempting to come up with other explanations. They also don't like it because it shows the limits of science. Because you can't penetrate before that first moment, really. You can only theorize in a very, very speculative kind of way. Robert Jastrow's book, God and the Astronomers, which came out in 79, it was revised in 92, deals with this at length. He goes into the empirical support for the Big Bang, which we'll talk about in a moment briefly. And then he gives responses of leading physicists who are repulsed by the idea. Not because the theory was not supportable empirically, but because they were bothered by it. It bugged them. They didn't like the idea of everything coming into existence out of nothing, because it showed their limits as scientists and also strongly indicates a supernatural dimension. Because some people define science as only what can be studied with respect to natural states. So if your science bumps up against a creator, it's not supposed to do that. Something must have gone wrong, because science is the study of natural causes and effects and not anything that transcends the natural realm, supposedly. This is a new and bogus and very biased view of science. But this is the view of science that motivates many practicing physicists, especially biologists, more than physicists, in fact, now. Okay, anything else on the argument from Cordwin so far? Yes, Paul? Well, we'll come back to that when we get to the pop theory, that it all popped into existence without a cause. Basically, there is absolutely no probability for that occurring, because when things occur in the universe, with the exception of some theoretical approaches to some quantum particles, no one assumes that things happen without some conditioning predecessor, without some cause. To deny that is to deny something very fundamental to our basic approach to reality. And you have to wonder if it's not kind of special pleading. Oh, if this leads to God, then I have to deny the principle. But you use the principle to explain just about everything else.